This is Screen Divers. In this week's episode, we are talking about 1992 Raising Kane. Directed by Brian De Palma, written by Brian De Palma, and produced by Gail Ann Hurd. Starring John Lithgow, Lolita Davidovich, Stephen Bauer, Francis Sternhagen, and tons of character actors. Cinematography by Stephen H. Burham. Edited by Robert Dalva, Paul Hirsch, and Benny Kohler. Music by the legendary Pino Donaggio, distributed by Universal Pictures. This movie has a running time of 88 minutes. It was made for a budget of $12 million and it raked $37.1 million on release. How are you guys? How are you, Ricky?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm not bad. I'm not bad. You know why? Because in this week's episode, we have a very special guest. The legendary, the amazing, the reprehensible, David Joshua Smith.
Hey, guys. Thank you for having me back.
How are you, Dave? Right. What's going on?
I'm doing good. I'm doing good.
Yeah. You're stepping in. You're stepping in for Steve, who just got married and he's on his way to Thailand, Vietnam. He's doing like he's going away for 2 weeks. Yeah. I hope he gets kidnapped, to be honest. Yeah.
Don't,
yeah. Hopefully.
Don't joke. Don't joke. I knew someone that got killed in Thailand. So.
You're joking.
No.
So you're telling me there's a chance?
Oh, what a way to start this episode.
Why not, man? Okay. I'm gonna get a phone call with someone going, "Diddy Mao, Diddy Mao."
Oh, mate.
I'm sorry. So who picked this movie, man?
I think it was you.
Yeah, I think you did.
That's unusual. It's unusual.
It's not unusual. You want to be loved by anyone. It's not unusual. You want to have fun with anyone. But when I see you hanging about with anyone. It's not unusual to see me cry. I wanna die.
A quintessential question must be asked. Ricky, what is this movie about?
If Whiplash was filmed in 70mm, you would have Raising Kane, including multiple personalities, including my own screaming at the TV, "When will it stop?"
Are you serious?
What do you mean?
What are you talking about? This movie's a blast. Yes.
Had you seen this film before?
I said to Sal when I sat down to watch this film, I have seen this film, but I think I've seen it in parts. And I guess I've never seen it from start to end because there were so many bits that I just couldn't take seriously in this film. And I was like, if I had watched it from start to end, I would have known how much whiplash you would get for the first 30 minutes of this film. It was hardcore. Like, ow. Ooh.
I don't think you're supposed to take this film seriously.
Thank God. That's right. And this is where I am going to hand it over to the both of you to hopefully make my rating higher before we get to ratings.
I think maybe that's what the purpose of all of this was. Perhaps myself and Dave plotted because we knew you were going to be a contrarian. You know, this is it's unacceptable. But anyway, like Dave just said.
I expect this is a polarizing film anyway for a lot of people.
It fucking is. And I got to tell you, I rewatched it without it. And this is my first viewing of the director's cut. And holy shit, it improves this movie tenfold. Which version did you watch, Ricky?
Director's cut.
Okay, well, there you go.
I didn't get around to finding the theatrical cut myself. I tried my hardest. But yeah, the director's cut that was reorganized by Pete Glendeblum. Glendeblum?
Yeah. What is it?
Right. No, another go. Please.
Glendeblum?
I'm going to leave both in the edit anyway.
Glendeblum. Anyway.
Glendeblum. Okay. Credit goes to him, yeah.
I think his version is now the one you can't really see. And I mean, because I've got a DVD copy of it and it's just the director's cut. It had nothing else on it. So,
yeah. I mean, if you've got qualms with this cut, do not go and watch the fucking theatrical because that's, you know, the linearity that they try to bring in just doesn't work. And the reason, I mean, if anything, it's quite clever It's very clever. If De Palma came out and said, "Oh, this is the way," I have my doubts. I'm not saying that De Palma is not telling the truth, but there's a big chance that he's not telling the truth.
No, I think he is, but we'll tell this. We'll go into.
Can you get De Palma on the phone? Can you call him? Come on, man. You know these people. Make a phone call.
I actually kind of have sideways connections to De Palma.
You do?
Well, there's two connections. One is like completely dead, but I went to school with a cousin. I went to college with a cousin of his. Her name was Annie Merlino at the time, but that was 30 years ago. But I also worked with one of the post-production companies I work for in New York. I work with Zahara, the girl from Redacted that De Palma kind of de facto adopted.
Oh, wow.
And brought back to the United States. And I worked with her. She was the receptionist at Picture Shop. Oh, not Picture Shop, but at Sim when I was there. And she's just the sweetest, most lovely girl. But
to be completely honest with you, if I was asking you to reach out to De Palma, it wouldn't be about this movie or anything like that. I would just ask a question, which is, you know the two-tone thing that he's got going on with his beard? Is that natural? Because it looks fucking amazing. I want that. What's his grooming regimen? I need to know what it does.
I don't know what his grooming regimen is. I do know that the guy apparently was obsessively wearing Zip sneakers for a long time.
But hey, if it's genetic, it's amazing. It's got this perfect two-tone thing. Like, I think the mustache is dark and the beard is white. It's mesmerizing. Man, like, on the version that I've got, first of all, a little bit, like, let's give our listeners a peek behind the curtain. I dared to send a voice message, an insulting, affectionately insulting, voice message that ended in fuck you both to Dave when he sent me a picture of his version of the movie, right? And okay. I mistook that version for a DVD version. He corrected me immediately. He goes, no. This is the shot release and it's the Blu-ray release. So
it has both versions.
Oh, well, there you go. See, he's doing it now. He did exactly the same thing on the WhatsApp message. But I get it because I would do the same to you. So, but Shout, Arrow, Criterion, all these companies kind of, you know, different names but same shit kind of thing, right? And here's the kicker. The picture that I posted all over social media and the picture that I sent you, and I was upset when I opened that thing. It was misleading.
Okay.
Yes. And I'll tell you what's going on. Apparently, Arrow at some point must have released the version that I thought I was buying. The version that I have on Blu-ray that I ordered 48 hours ago and then it was delivered to me yesterday, it's not the director's cut.
What?
It's a theatrical.
No.
Yes, it's a great transfer, but it's a theatrical. And thanks to the people at Solid VPN, I'm going to get arrested for this. I managed to. they're not sponsoring us, but if you're looking for a VPN service, you know, do you care about your privacy? Yeah. Do you? Well, if you do, Solid VPN is possibly the solution you are seeking. With one payment, you are getting a lifetime subscription to a VPN service that will protect your identity, will protect your online activity. And if you listen to the show, and you don't want your hard drive wiped at some point, you need it. So Solid VPN.
Is it right that you can use the VPN to put Netflix on, and if you use the Australian Netflix, you've got all of the WWE back catalog and the current pay-per-view file videos and all of that stuff that are coming through right now?
Well, right or not, you can achieve all of that with Solid VPN. So they're not fucking sponsoring shit.
Could you also get Stan, which is an Australian thing, and get the Surfer as part of the Stan package as well? Oh.
You can also do that with Solid VPN.
We haven't mentioned Disney Plus yet. We haven't mentioned Disney Plus. Quick, let's something
Disney,
from Disney Plus.
Disney, Amazon. Anyway, point of the matter.
The Surfer is on Hulu right now.
We're trying to get money from
everybody. There we go. The Surfer is on Hulu in America.
Yes. Yes, which is Disney here as well, anyway. Is it Disney there as well? Hulu? They bought it, right?
They're trying to... Mm-hmm. Disney bought Hulu, and they're trying to kind of envelop it into the...
Yeah.
So I think within a year or two, I think Hulu will just be gone. It's just going to be Disney Plus.
In all other territories apart from America, they are one. You get Disney Plus, you get FX, and you get Hulu. You get all of it. So
in America, we have a bias where if it's like if it's Disney, it has to be the kids stuff. So they didn't want all of the adult grown up stuff on the Disney platform, and now.
Ooh, but that's how you do it, right? To diversify the brand a little. Otherwise, it's But anyway, whatever. They own everything. The mouse owns everything. Now, in regards to the version that I have, right? I spent 50 minutes raging around the house and just venting with Anne. I was just sitting there going, basically, who gives a shit? But she's immune to it. For 50 minutes, I was like, and then I realized, well, you know, because we were about to sit down and watch the movie. I didn't want to watch that cut. But preemptively, I remembered that I sourced a copy of the director's cut, which was decent anyway. However, I don't regret buying that because then I watched all the special features on that disc. And you guys may have seen, possibly, I don't know if it was an interview that was done just with Arrow, but there is an interview with John Lithgow.
Oh, no, I haven't seen that.
Well, there you go. It, for me, is the reason to watch the movie. It's no secret that I am a huge John Lithgow fan, thanks to Third Rock from the Sun, which, you know, once again, that was my ticket in, I think, with him. You know, I have friends that before I really got into, because I got into Third Rock later in life, not while it was running. I think it was the end of the run. And now I get it. It's also so hard to find right now, but it's range on that show. I mean, there's an episode where he plays a good guy and a bad guy, and that's fucking Kane. In retrospect, when you watch it, it's, you know, he's amazing. He overacts, but like James Woods, you know what I mean? There's two actors that I think I can draw a parallel there for some reason between the two.
I'd say Lithgow. I mean, Woods, I think, is always at like 150%. While I think Lithgow can dial it a lot more, into a lot more nuanced. You said you grew up with Third Rock, which is Lithgow at 150%. I went older.
Buckaroo Banzai, is that where you want to go?
No, it was not Buckaroo Banzai. My introduction was Lithgow muted. It was the Manhattan Project. It was and Harry and the Hendersons, and that.
Yeah, was, of course. Yeah,
and Lithgow is just like a normal person as opposed to.
Well, yeah, he plays the family man in Henry and the Anderson, doesn't he?
But yeah, I mean, this film has that though, and that I think that's a good element. that's a good element of this film, which is. Precisely. It's allowing Lithgow to be all facets of Lithgow that he can be. But I just...
50 Shades of Lithgow, is that what you're saying?
Pretty much. But the daytime movie, the daytime soap opera aspect of this really just annoyed me.
Why?
Really got under
it's
my skin.
Fucking gorgeously trashy and kitsch.
But...
Amazing,
I mean, I want to talk more about this later on, but there's just something about, especially when she first meets Jack in the clock shop. Oh my God.
After the funeral, I was a block of ice. I couldn't bear to feel. So I felt nothing. I'm sorry I made such a mess of it. I'm staying at the Garden Court. If you wanted to, just talk. I'll be there tonight. We could... I saw you come in with Carter and your little girl. I guess I just didn't thaw out fast enough.
It's like softcore, Hallmark, fucking weird. Yeah, I know. But that's the you know, this time around myself and Annie were in, because it's like, oh shit, this is like, it feels like you're eating too much cake. It's just, you know,
but
what I mean?
It's not cake. It's the icing. It's just constantly overly
it's just a
sweet,
ball of
and
icing.
You're just shoving it in. And as much as you taste the sugar and the icing just like sitting on top, you can't help but shove more in. And there's going to be a point, and for me, it was about 15 minutes in, there's going to be a point where you're just like, why do I keep doing this to myself? I'm just a fat pig. I'm a fused fat pig.
It is so like that, that it's like spoonful, shot of insulin, spoonful, shot of insulin. Let's like.
Oh, so that was my issue. I wasn't shooting the insulin into my liver.
So I think if Ricky's having this issue, I think we need to talk about the two different cuts then.
Yeah.
Do we? Because, yeah, the other one is less, I think. Well, the, I don't know, for whatever reason.
No, no, no.
Or more.
There is no. The amount of footage between the two cuts is there isn't any.
It's
was
minimal.
No,
it's like 20-something seconds, right?
Yeah, because they had to duplicate some footage of her sitting on the park bench in order to add some continuity.
But this is a proper recut. Because it feels like a different movie with the same stuff.
All they did was they took the second act and moved it to the first act.
Right. Exactly.
And that's it. So when you watch, so when Ricky is dealing with all this bad soap opera, what I think happened is that De Palma was very aware, you know, while cutting the film, that and began to have misgivings that the Lolita Davidovich story is not as engaging as anything that John Lithgow is doing.
Right. Yeah.
And they got very worried that it's like, oh God, we're going to drive the audience away with this bad soap opera.
Mm.
And let's move up all of this Lithgow, you know, the first Lithgow kidnapping into the first act, and hook the audience in, and then we can go double back and do the, especially because time is such a fractured element in this film, that they can get away with it.
I have heard that Pete Glinderblum, that he was very much like, you know, there was a masterpiece in this film that I could see, but it just didn't work. But for me, there was just too much homage to his earlier work in this film.
Yeah.
For me, I couldn't help, like, as I was watching this, and I knew how it ended. I knew the shots from the motel and the beautiful, like, cascading slow motion shots. But I think when it got put all together,
that is so fucking De Palma, dude.
Yeah, exactly.
It's what
we wait for. Yeah, and it's also like, you know, it's the tracking shots of Scarface. Yeah. You know, you can liken it to so much other De Palma. But
it's self-indulgent.
Yeah, it's extremely
self-indulgent.
And when I was watching it, I couldn't help but think, I could be watching a better De Palma right now. And you know what I did yesterday? So I saw this, laughed my ass off, and I couldn't believe I watched it after Trick or Treat. My Halloween movie of choice this year was Trick or Treat. So I watched Trick or Treat.
Which is a classic for so many people, I guess. Yeah.
And then I watched Raising Cain.
Yeah.
And throughout Raising Cain, I was just sort of like, yes, I absolutely laughed my ass off.
Mate, the word babies is so fucking loaded in this.
Oh my God. Anyway,
wait a second. We just saw Dave's cat. What's your cat's name, man?
That's Tiger.
Tiger. Okay, he's very cute.
So you know what I did straight after? So the following night, I put on Dress to Kill.
You did that the following night. I finished Raising Cain, and I went, I want more Lithgow. Not a shot of insulin. And then, not that I need it, but I went and watched Blowout.
There you go. Because
okay.
I was watching Blowout today, this morning, while the kids were getting ready. Yeah, exactly.
And it's far from perfect. But there are some sequences that are fantastic, and they are ruined by our conversation about the conversation.
Mm-hmm.
you fucking ruined that movie for me, which was made before or after?
The conversation was made before.
Before,
yeah, it was about 10 years. Well, no,
exactly
5 or 6 years before. Yeah.
So you destroyed that movie because it's, I don't even
but
know if
you
it's
know,
paying homage.
You know,
it's like
Blowout. Yeah. What it's based on?
It's Chappell.
It's what?
It's Chappaquiddick. It's the Edward Kennedy, the going off the bridge with the prostitute. And the...
Yeah, there's that element, but it's actually based also on the Italian-British film Blow Up.
Well, yeah.
On Blow Up? Yeah. Okay, yeah. The Antonioni. The Antonioni one.
Yeah. So, whereas, and again, there's a hard... This is slightly my issue with De Palma. I love De Palma. But then once you become a certain age and you become more of a cinephile, you start looking at his tricks and you start looking at what he always does. So watching Dress to Kill, first of all, I did not remember how softcore porn it was. It was mind-blowing how softcore porn it is.
Especially, fucking great.
Especially the unrated cut.
Yeah.
At what point did Sally walk into the room while we were watching?
Shall I tell you what? She walked in towards the end, and I was so happy because she missed all the masturbation.
It's a sexy movie, though, man. Did you get laid afterwards? It's a sexy movie.
No, because she just saw Michael Caine and. So that is Michael Caine, right? I'm like, that is Michael Caine. Yes.
Yeah. But again, dude, tell me at what point of this conversation we're going to talk about fucking Snake Eyes. Because
we might have to do it as a best of the worst at some point style.
Look, Ben, let's stay on this movie. And I think the person that irritated me the most out of the cast here is Greg Henry.
Okay.
Yes.
Why?
Because everything about him. Everything's like, if you ever walked into, or dealt with police, well, that's the thing. If it was ever an instance in my life in which I have to deal with police by explaining something and someone handled me the way this guy handles everything, I would have gone, fuck you, man. I pay your wage. You listen to me and pay attention now. Dismissive of absolutely everything. Those two cops were like, whatever. They've got a guy there. Do you remember that entire sequence with the guy who was retired? Yeah.
But I worked another Nick's case 20 years ago.
20 years ago? What are you talking about?
I'm talking about that guy's old man.
Are you sure?
Same name, same face.
So what did your Dr. Nick's do?
We got an anonymous tip he was buying babies. I remember we caught him with five.
Five? Was he starting a basketball team?
Who knows?
So what happened to him?
After he got convicted, he jumped bail and left the country. He was Swedish or something. We couldn't extradite him.
Great. Thanks for sharing,
Just
Mac.
Just wait a minute here. At his trial, an associate testified against him, a Dr. Lynn Waldheim. Still works around here. I just called Waldheim's office. They tell me the doctor checked into the hospital.
What's the matter with him?
It's a her, cancer. I told her about the kids disappearing and one of their fathers was a Dr. Nix. She says she'll be right
it's
over.
It's so funny.
Yeah. It's super funny, dude. Yeah, it's super exposition.
It is fantastic. I mean, and Lithgow is there behind two windows. They could have stopped the rest of the movie there and then, but they didn't. It's just, it's unbelievable, man. I told you, this is like that cake that you're overindulging in. This cut in particular was fantastic to me. There's a little bit of different kinds of trash. It's awesome. I mean, the last shot of this movie, dude. Shot of this movie, we had to rewind it three times because I never wanted to rewatch it every time. I think that's my issue, though.
Yeah, and again, Twalo rips off everyone. That's the shot from Tenebra.
But he's obsessed with giallo, right? And is he Italian heritage? De Palma? Is he or is he South American?
Surely.
He's Italian.
Yeah.
Does he need a red cap with an M on it for you to believe him? Or a green cap with an L?
Mamma mia! Now, anyway, point of the matter is I don't know if I can't even say anymore that he pays homage to giallo. I think he's got his flavor of Italian-American giallo. It's like I wonder if the United States would have ever been introduced to giallo without him. I don't know. But this movie is much more Hitchcock than giallo.
Yeah.
It's like it switches gears, you know? I mean, and mate, I'm pretty sure that by the end of this conversation, your rating of this movie will be higher.
I don't think so, because...
I think you will.
Because, and you were saying that you actually didn't like Lieutenant Terry, but he gets given all the good lines. I mean,
I didn't like him as a cop.
Oh, okay.
But absolutely.
It's a Hollywood trope that the cops don't know what the hell's going
but
on.
Even the power, like the power stance when he's sitting down, and the, I don't know, not that my eyes veered in that direction, but his trousers always made a tent when he sat down. There's a moment when he's sitting down, legs open. And I'm thinking, you're fucking way too relaxed for this, dude.
Wow.
You got a grieving widow, or she thinks it's just fucking.
But if you compare, again, this is why.
And Tom Bauer, he's an enabler. He's the other cop was meant to reel it in. No. Fucking both of them. Sorry. Anyway, go on.
No, well, I mean, like, I feel like Greg Henry was picked because, what's his name? Dennis Franz wasn't available or that. Because
he's one of the regulars.
Yeah, and his character's exactly the same in Dressed to Kill. A cop who, one, doesn't know what he's doing, and two, doesn't care. There's that whole bit in Dressed to Kill.
Exactly.
Yeah, there's that whole
looking at his watch. Is it 5 o'clock yet?
Dressed to Kill where he's talking to Nancy Ellen and Nancy Ellen's like, and you let me go to his house? And he's like, yeah, I was at the baseball game with my son. Of course I wasn't going to stop you.
Mate, Frances Sternhagen, she sells the bullshit in this like Dan Aykroyd.
It is not a psychological state one wishes to acquire. Every time there is another trauma, there may be another personality. Pretty soon there are scores of them running around inside your head, squabbling amongst themselves as to which one gets to control the consciousness. Only one personality can control the consciousness at one time.
She's great.
She reminded me of the medium in Profondo Rosso.
Oh,
it's
like, yeah.
It's that kind of presence. I don't know. It's, and also in this cut, the way it's kind of like giving you too much in this cut, though. I think taking away the linearity of the movie, they still fear that people would miss some things. I would have left out a couple of things, and it irritated me. There's a bit when she's giving us the exposition. This is at the end of that beautiful shot that makes David Joshua Smith come every time because he's posted it. He fucking loves it. It's a rope, and it's a beautiful. I come to it as well. It's
of all the De Palma Steadicam shots, that this is the one that's my favorite.
You put that shot in my spank bank, so there you go. So a wank bank or whatever you want to call it,
because and of course the great inside jokes in the middle of it.
Oh, yeah. Mate, it's like, we're going to discuss those.
Yeah, we'll talk about it. Yeah,
yeah, we'll talk about it. But there's a bit that at the end of that they are. I don't even know if the elevator, because it looks like the. Whenever they enter the elevator, you don't know if it's going up or down. It doesn't matter.
They're going to the morgue, so presumably they're
going down. But it just feels like it's going up for whatever reason. Like they left something on the desk upstairs. I don't know what it was. But when we get downstairs in the subterranean morgue office, that it's all stainless steel. There's so much of it, even when it's not needed. But she's leaning against everything and everything is metal. But anyway, and she's giving us the exposition, and she drops this thing that I wish they took out of this edit. She goes, she complains about the wig she's wearing. Don't fucking tell us. I would have left that out. It's all in the viewer's hand, and it's like a little check of gun for later. Mm. So you'll know it's Litgo. Like, you wouldn't fucking work out that the guy is 6'1" and he's got hairy arms and legs.
The
palm is
full of it, though. Like, again. Sorry, I know I'm talking more about Dressed to Kill. Okay.
Yeah, but wait a second. This movie was, okay, leave Dressed to Kill out. We'll talk about that later. But in this, they recut the movie, right? And I like this edit. Mm. I would have left out little things like this.
Mm.
But again, you know, I think they I don't know why, like, the idea of taking the linear, I see why they went with more of a linear storyline for the theatrical release, but this one really works for this movie. Like, as much as that, you know, I'm talking to you, Ricky, you're right, there's a very Hallmark kind of slash softcore, soap opera, you know, soft tones, that it's a thing of the time. If anything, this is among those two or three movies that are not period pieces that De Palma has done. You know, Carlito's Way, it's a period piece. Mm. The Untouchables is a period piece. Yeah. They're all, and those work because they're far removed from the now. Mm. And this movie is very fucking 1990. It really is.
I do see that, but I can't help but think about his whole body of work. But again, we'll talk about that later. You know what? We've missed out a question because we don't have the illustrious Steve here. David, what is your history with this?
Can you ask the question of sounding like a douche, please?
Okay. Let me just, I'll ask it straighter this time, I guess. David.
No, it wasn't gay enough earlier. You want to... Straighter. What do you mean?
Hey,
straighter?
David. You know, what was your history with this film?
Well, Ricky, it was...
Go ahead.
I saw this in theaters when it came out. It was at the Chatham Cinema where I grew up, and I went with some friends, and we all, it was just
on release. You watched this, or was it like
No, no, we saw this in the original release when it came out in theaters.
So, would you say this was like, I don't know, early on in your in viewing De Palma films, or do you think you saw quite a lot of De Palma and that's why you were going to see Raising Kane?
I had seen enough De Palma at that point. I hadn't seen everything yet, but I'd certainly seen my fair share.
It's a lot to ask, but what do you think your high watermark was, if you can, you know? Do we have to hypnotize you? Do you need to regress to 30 years ago so we get accurate information? Don't look around the eyes. Just look inside the eyes. Don't look around the eyes. Do you remember what your high watermark for De Palma was back in 1992?
Probably The Untouchables, because I don't think I had seen Blowout at that point. So it would have been The Untouchables.
Okay. Was Scarface before The Untouchables for you?
I didn't see Scarface until after I saw this.
Oh.
So Scarface, I came late to Scarface. So, and Scarface is never one of my favorite De Palmas.
That's just talking about it. It's been a while, so I think I need to go back to it.
Yeah, I think Scarface is a little one note. I mean, it's incredible filmmaking, but I think it's a little.
You're never getting
one note.
Invited again. It's okay. It's fine. Well, you get to sleep more because every time you're on the show, it's fucking 4 a.m.
Yeah.
So anyway, you're getting your weekends back, Dave.
Yeah. I mean, I like it, but I don't love it. In fact, I think the original's better.
Fair.
Different things. I mean, you could say that's story-driven and Scarface is completely driven by its lead.
Yeah.
And it's actually important that we talk about that because Stephen Bauer is an important part of Scarface.
Yes.
And
here,
he plays such a fucking...
Mook. He plays a mook. He plays an absolute... Ugh.
But yeah, I digress. We took you off course.
Yeah, Greg Hungary is your weak point. Stephen Bauer is my weak point in this film.
Who wants to talk about the scene when he's taken to his car?
Yeah, I know. wait, I got blood on this?
Excuse me, sir. Excuse me. I'm Lieutenant Terry, Bayview Police. I'd like to ask you a few questions.
That's just a short ride and a couple of questions, okay? You'll help us out a lot.
Short ride? I can help you out here. I can talk to you.
Do you have a car here in the lot?
Yes, I have. It's my car right there.
This is your car?
I mean, it's a rental car.
Could you give the keys to Detective Carlton, please?
I rented it.
You ride with us.
I don't understand what... Sure, you have the keys. You have the keys. I just rented it yesterday. I'm visiting, here, these are,
What is this? What is this?
I must have rubbed...
Huh? This looks
I've
like
never
blood.
Seen that.
Did blood. You open this?
Yeah, sure. Just the round key. I don't know what you expect to find. I'm not hiding anything. Weapons or something. Oh, my God.
The scene is kind of shoehorned together because... You know, let's keep the story going. And it is ridiculous.
I wish we saw more of that. I wish we saw the aftermath right after opening the boot because you barely see it.
In the original edit, okay, do you see Kane setting up the car before Stephen Bauer gets to it, or does Stephen Bauer get to it, sees it, and then you see the flashback of Kane's work?
No, because the in the original cut, you do not. What happens in the original cut is that Kane goes to his. In the first act of the film, he goes to his father's house, to the motel.
Yeah.
After he drops off the kid, and then we cut to the scene in the clock shop.
Oh my god! Yeah, that's why it doesn't work, man.
Yeah.
Oh my god. It doesn't work. This viewing was so much better. And then
the clock shop, because and then it goes to the whole romance between right. Lily Davidovich and.
Look, there's a sequence that made this movie for me, you know. And yes, I agree with Ricky. Like, but I attuned to I come with you, man, about all the trashy, like all the kitsch in this. But I attuned to it, and then it became something I enjoyed. You know what I mean? Like, it was natural. I didn't have to force myself.
This is very, very arch, very stylized, very. You're either going to click into this or you're not.
There's one thing about it.
The fact that we have two people here that like the film and Ricky does not is probably about on par.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah. You said it. You said it at the beginning of this podcast. It's polarizing, right? It is. Yeah. It's always been polarizing, this movie. But I did not like the theatrical cut. I always appreciated John Lithgow. This was one of the worst De Palma movies for me. Ricky, I'm with you. But this time around... That was super enjoyable, to the point in which when we finished, I said to Anna, do you want to watch another, do you want to see more Let Go? She goes, yes, put something else on. It's like, that's not a thing that Anna does. You know, two movies in a row, that's not going to happen in this house. But she was ready, she was primed for it, because it was enjoyable, but we attuned to it. So I agree with everything, all the qualms you have about this, but I kind of tuned in. It's like you have a CB radio and all of a sudden you found this frequency, you know, and that's what happened. But... To all the Gen Z and Gen Y that don't listen to the show, CB radio, fucking just go look it up. But in regards to the non-linearity in this movie, there's one sequence that made this movie for me, and it's all reconnecting to the sequence at the beginning in which Lolita Davidovich plays Jenny. Jenny's in the playground, and... You know, it's a very relatable, I assume I don't have kids, but it's relatable, right? That you meet another parent that you know, and they have a conversation. I mean, they must be close friends. At one point, I thought, is she family? Is she a sister or whatever? But they must be close, because she reveals a lot, dude. She reveals a lot in detail.
Too much detail.
She tells, well, what's the name of the actor? It's Mel Harris, which I've seen as a character actress that we've seen. She plays Sarah here. She's a confidant, almost, right? She's a confidant. A confidant. And they're talking about, you know, personal shit. And Jenny tells Sarah that, you know, she was making love to Carter. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, the kid cries, he gets up. And he stops, and she was surprised by it all. I love the fact that that's shown in this cut, because I have no memory of any of this in the linear cut. Even if it was there, it did not fucking matter. But the way the narrative is presented to the viewer in this cut, it's non-linear, and yeah, it kind of makes it. It made it for me. I was expecting for more, and I got more. You get more. The back and forth here is very welcome. So, and this is down to the editor. Because the editor had the footage, because this is actually hard to do on post-production. Like, as a first release, this is hard to do, dude. Then people would have really praised it. So they really fucked this up. Because if it's true that they tested it and this is the version that they wanted to release and it didn't work, that's when I said, Dave, that's what I was saying earlier. I struggle to believe that this was the Palmer's vision. I like to believe that this guy came up with the recut and Palmer went, oh, yeah, that's what I wanted to do.
Well,
you know what I mean?
From what I understand is that while they were working on the post-production to this film, he was working with a couple editors that were not his usual guys.
But wasn't this recut in 2012 by this dude?
Oh, no, you know, not, this is, I'm talking about the original theatrical.
There's an, in 92.
Okay. Yeah. Okay,
yeah, in 92. That he was using, part of Universe. I'm not sure how they wound up getting involved, but his usual editors were not involved. And then he brought in Paul Hirsch, who he had done work with before. Mm. And they managed to kind of salvage the film and cut it together. And it was in the process of that they decided that maybe the original script, we move up the John Lithgow stuff first. Mm. It sounds like, De Palma got nervous about how, the film was supposed to be, was going to play.
It was going to be received. Yeah. I get it. I just don't see.
Well, you know how this 2012 cut came around? It was from a leaked original script. So in the script, it was the way De Palma wanted the film. And so that's where Pete Glinderblom had decided, that's how he fan-edited it.
Yes, yep. I saw that on the featurette as well. And
that fan-edit is on Vimeo if you need to find it.
Well, there you go. But there's also like a featurette here describing, I think someone made it, it's called a visual essay. It's a good breakdown. There were many different versions of this movie. You could continue to cut this with what's available. But it's fascinating, man. It's fascinating because the non-linear narrative, to this extent, I see why. And I have to agree with De Palma. Perhaps it wasn't going to be received as well. This is like pre-Pulp Fiction, dude.
Yeah.
Like before, if we got some non-linear storytelling, it was either Hitchcock but it was a flashback. It wasn't like the first act of a movie. Do you understand? Like, we get a lot of back and forth here at the beginning. And somehow, again, credit to what's his name? Because I want to hear you mispronounce it again, Ricky.
Mispronounce it again? I'll do it again. Pete Glinderblom. I'm saying that because he's Dutch. So, of course, I'm going to.
Is he Dutch?
Yeah, he's Dutch.
Okay.
And Pete's spelled, of course, P-E-E-T. That's how Dutch he is. He doesn't,
Hey, that I lived most of my adult life pronouncing Gouda.
Okay.
The cheese as Gouda. Yeah. How do you pronounce it?
Gouda.
It's Gouda.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is that what you... Yeah?
Gouda. No.
The wedding that we talked about at the beginning, Steve's wedding, Steve is now married to Mari. Mari is Dutch. And I got corrected.
Oh, I bet you
by
did.
By Mari. And dude, are you ready for it? Because it's fucking amazing. You ready?
Yep.
Gouda. Oh, there's a bit of an echo as well. It's perfect. Gouda. That's how it's pronounced. But anyway, you were saying...
What?
Sorry. That's how it's pronounced. It's pronounced Gouda.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right. Well, so this visual essay that you saw, was it actually narrated by Pete Goldblum?
No.
Okay, so I've seen, I've seen a visual essay where he directed, wrote, and put together all the visuals. And he was talking about how he edited.
So it's his featurette. Do you remember what it's called?
Off the top of my head, no, but I'll look it up right now because it was on Vimeo.
Let me get the disc as well. You get your disc, and we'll look at the back of the case together.
Yeah, okay. that'll make some good listeners.
I'll go get mine.
With all the ears that are listening to us, so I'll just keep chatting while he goes away. But in the featurette that Pete Goldblum did, he talked about how this all came from a love of this film from when he saw it in 92. And I guess at some point when he did see the script, he was like, yeah, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to recreate this because I've got nothing better to do with my time. So I am going to recreate one of my favorite De Palma films. And it's just crazy because you think to yourself, if you ever took a film that you loved, like it's like me taking There Will Be Blood and going, you know what would be really great about There Will Be Blood? If I put the very end of the film at the start and then matched it up all the way through. It's a bit of a crazy task to take on.
I failed you all. I failed myself. I failed our listeners. In this misleading release that I bought of Raising Kane, there is a featurette that I didn't watch, and now I wish I did. You probably have seen it. Have you talked to the others? It's an interview with Paul Hirsch, the first editor.
Yeah.
The editor of the theatrical, yeah. That's the one. What?
Yes. So the featurette I saw is called Raising Kane Recut a Video Essay. That's why I couldn't remember it, because it's very much by the books.
Well, the one that I've got in here, that's a similar title. Oh, my God. How much? This is called Father's Day, a brand new video essay about the multiple versions of Raising Kane by Chris Dumas.
Oh, I would like to see that.
That sounds good.
What's yours? What was in your...
Jeez, now I have to go get it. Hang on.
Ah, yeah, there we go.
Go get it. What's it? Hey, go on Wikipedia again.
No, what?
Well, why not?
Who am I looking for now? Lithgow?
Have you noticed our guests have to leave when we do this?
No, it's because you ask for it when they leave.
I'm more uncomfortable with the fact that I'm... Hey, man, you're back. There you go. Hey, we'll go on Wikifeet later.
Oh, I found it.
What is it? What did you find?
Oh.
Hey, look for Greg Henry's feet.
No, but
dude.
I have found
what?
John Lithgow's feet on King Lear on
You're
stage.
Joking, mate. Yeah. Show me. Yeah.
So the version I have has a bunch of interviews, but also a changing Kane, the Brian De Palma's cult classic Restored.
Oh.
Huh. So that's on the Shout Blue.
Wow. We all saw a different featurette.
Yes, this is going to spur some of our listeners to just leave a comment going, and I've got this version. For sure. Anyway, going back to that sequence, right? Even if it's fragmented, you kind of wait for it. You wait for it. And I didn't feel that way on the theatrical release at all.
Yeah.
So, I mean, even, mate, the first time, can I tell you something, Ricky?
Hmm.
Ricky. When they're in the car, all right? This is right before he does the, like, sending the eyes or whatever. Does it. Yes, which is amazing. And it's so telegraphed as well, because he keeps coughing in such emphatic manner. Mm-hmm. You know that something's going to happen. When he does that, just before he gets caught, it's the first time that we see that a stress response will bring up another personality for Carter. And that's when we meet Kane for the first time.
Mm.
And when he comes on, I never thought about it, and it's your fault again, Ricky. You conditioned me into thinking this way, which is bad. As soon as Kane pops up, I went, hey, that's John Lithgow doing a James Spader. Am I wrong? Am I wrong, Ricky?
No, he is like an archetype of an 80s, whatever you want to call it.
Douchebag, yeah.
But yeah, he comes in and he does a very good impression of all of
James
that.
James Spader.
it's so many people. You know, the reason why we talk about James Spader so fondly from the 80s is because he is a symbol of an archetype of that 80s douchebag that
Absolutely.
We all know and we all love from all of those terrible films.
I wonder if he will visit today. I'm pretty sure he will.
I think he's raring to go, but he's just checking his hairdo and whether he's like rolled up enough doobies for that
fair
moment.
Fair enough. Looking for his cigarettes into his like blazer or something.
Going back to what you said, I am with you. There is definitely a certain element there of there's a lot of not telegraphing, but there's a lot of very good connective tissue going throughout this film. When I said earlier that this film gave me whiplash for the first half an hour, there were certain elements of it that were great. Like there's that bit where you see her visually and it looks like she's on the leaves of the park. She sits up and she's in the bedroom and at some point the leaves disappear. And that's not a CGI effect. That's a practical effect. There's something magical about those shots.
Yeah.
But the thing that gave me whiplash was her like remembering like being in the park and seeing a shadowy figure grab at Jack's coat, and it's like that weird left to right pan over and over again. And then all of a sudden, oh, or is it that she's in the bedroom? She suddenly wakes up and Kane's hovering over her, being like, oh, you've had a bad dream, love. You know, in a sort of Dracula sort of like, oh.
Oh, is it? No, it's Kane. It's Kane. You're right.
Yeah, it does turn out to be Kane, but it is, you're meant to think it's Carter. Well, basically, by that point in the director's cut, you don't know the multiple personalities yet. There's something about this film that I believe still doesn't work. And I think the acting's good. And there are many set pieces in this that are amazing. I am not faulting at all the going through the police station. That's a very long sequence, very hard to do and amazing. And even...
Are you talking about the rope shot?
Yeah.
He's talking about the Steadicam, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, there was only 5 takes.
Yes.
It's an insane... Because there's dialogue throughout as well. It's fucking insane.
Yep.
It's not just go over it. You know how long that is? Does anyone here know how long that is? Exactly.
It's about 4.5 minutes. 4.5 minutes.
Fucking hell, man. Now because we got. Yeah, what did you say?
But again, it's like I can't help but compare this film to Dress to Kill, but I'll bring that back in a second. But anyway. Yeah. But anyway, I was going to say...
You're talking, I'm going for a smoke. Okay, you guys talk. You guys talk so I don't interrupt you. How about that?
My God. Anyway, my point was, even like the amazing setup shots, including the one going through the police station and all that stuff, even to an extent, the mugging that John Lithgow does when he's having a character change or he's speaking to another character within himself, they're great. Like, the one thing that should have taken me out was actually him as Josh, the little boy, turning around to the camera and turning into Margot. That should have taken me out. I should have been done there. I should have been like, I'm not watching this anymore. This is like only slightly better than some of the B-movies that I enjoy. I feel like, personally, there's so many elements of the story that doesn't work. There's something about his relationship with Jenny, Jack doesn't really make sense. It feels a little bit like a MacGuffin having the doctor suddenly turn up and be like, he looks so much like his father and all of that stuff, because all she's there for is basically to like set him up for another moment, or set somebody else up for another moment. Yeah.
And you're not wrong. I mean, you're complaining that the film isn't realistic, and I don't think the realism is what De Palma's going for at all in this film. This is De Palma, I think, having had horrendous experience. You know, he had incredible success with The Untouchables. He had a miserable experience making a film that he thought was very good with Casualties of War. But it was a brutal shoot that wound up a film that is culturally forgotten.
Mm-hmm.
And then Bonfire of the Vanities, which became one of the most notorious flops in the history of cinema. This film, I think, is him rediscovering, you know, finding out again what it is that he loves about cinema. And he's going back and he's rediscovering his roots. And so, yeah, you do find nods to Dress to Kill. He copies the entire car going in the swamp sequence from Psycho.
Yeah.
Which,
it's a fantastic scene.
Yeah.
The scene itself is actually fantastic. And it's fantastic because John Lithgow really sells that almost verging onto having a panic attack, having anxiety, knowing that the car's not dropping. And not only is the car not dropping, the sun's coming up. But not only that, his wife's not even dead. You know, there's like so many things piling on. And it's great. It's actually really good. But I don't think it connects. And that's my issue with this film. I feel like there's a lot to... And look, this is me talking as a Troma fan. I love Troma movies. I go into Troma all the time. I go into terrible films all the time. And I'm just like, it doesn't matter that that scene doesn't make sense. It doesn't matter that that person's wearing a different wig by the time they get to the next scene. It doesn't matter that actually you can tell a body double very quickly or a stuntman very quickly, or you can tell like where they're like, oh, the greatest one is in Terra Firma, where, and I love all the behind the scenes stuff on Troma. So in Terra Firma, when they got a stuntman to come in and do a full body burn, and he basically only got his arm and his shoulder alight, and he was acting like, oh, that's as much as we can do. And literally Lloyd Kaufman's going, oh, but on Toxic Avenger, I got a full body burn. Like, why, what's going on here? So I understand terrible movies, and I understand made-for-TV movies and all of that stuff. But at least there's something about those movies that I can, like, keep a hold on to. This one, when it came to the storylines or the connective tissues between them, I love the individual. And I think this is why when Umbar said to me, we're going to do Raising Kane, I was like, yeah, great. There's this shot. There's this scene. I love that scene. But actually sitting down and watching them all connected together, I was like, what is this shit? And I'll tell you, the bit that actually made me laugh so hard and kind of like switched me off to taking any other elements of this on a like, no, this is a good film, oh, it's a fun film or whatever, was the scene where Jenny initially cheats with Jack.
Yeah.
Dude, did you guys talk about the scene, the flashback in the hospital?
Well, no, we're about to now. That's what I've introduced. That scene.
It's amazing. It's amazing.
Jack's wife, Emma, was my patient, dying of lung cancer. It was agonizing for him, but he came every night to sit with her. My heart went out to him. I wanted so much to take away some of his pain. Then I realized it was more than that. I was falling in love with him.
So many things are... Well, first of all, let's talk about the placement of that, because again, we're talking about... If you look at the timeline of the film, it's like it takes place... It's a flashback within a dream sequence, within a fantasy of... Like, there's three... It's like Inception layer kind of... narratives here with a voiceover.
When his dying wife, it's amazing, dude. But that was the response to the rest of the film.
Yeah,
like it's there's a moment when he's with Dr. Waldheim, which is Frances Stanhagen, right? And she's telling the story. She's telling the story about how she dealt with her father, basically, because she was an assistant, right, back then. So, and you know that's what how this for anyone that hasn't seen this movie, we're not really spoiling it.
There's
I don't think
much you can
this.
Spoil.
Yeah. You can't spoil it. You know, like, it's not a whodunit. We know who's done it. That's the thing. There's no qualms about who's done this. Even the entire sequence, like I said earlier, about the wig and everything. Like, and by the way, if you were looking, we were looking for shots of Lithgow's feet. There's got to be.
I've got it.
Shot must be on Wiki feet.
Yeah,
right?
I've got it right here. If you want to hold on, I'll just
you
bring
find
it up.
John
feet? Got it. I've got it straight up. Like, I had it ready because I knew that was there. We go, John Lithgow's feet in the elevator, waiting to come off. Which again, you know, like. I don't want to
Anne,
keep parking.
Come and look at Lidgo's feet.
Oh, do you
come
want me to show it again?
Yes, please.
All right.
For our listeners, it's going to be in the comments. Go to our Facebook page. Go to the post about Anne on his ear.
There you go. John Lithgow's feet.
Now, it could be a double.
Yep.
Because you never see his
feet. From Wiki
feet. Oh, there you go. Him as King Lear from Wiki feet. Yeah. Dirty feet. Dirty feet.
Wait. Do you know when that production happened? I went to we went to see him on stage. He plays Roald Dahl in The Giant, which, by the way, Dave, again, we got you tickets. Zriki is paying for the tickets for you to go and see him in the New York's production.
No, I'm not.
You know, it's the second gift you get from us. Do you remember last time you went to see Glengarry Glen Ross?
That was really nice.
There you go.
Yeah,
Zriki, did you get the tickets for him yet?
No, of course not.
Well, that's bad.
Anyway, the one thing I would also say is a bit of a mystery, because it was really stressing myself and Sally out, was what was happening to the kids.
Did you sit down and watch this with Sally?
Yeah, of course I did. Yeah.
Was she laughing as well?
In the same way I was laughing. We were both sort of like, oh, what the hell? Oh, yeah, that's
exactly
stupid.
That's what you meant to do, though.
No, but it was a lot more, what the hell? You know, again, it's like after watching Trick or Treat and then watching, you know, it's a different level of comedy.
Yeah, but you did that to yourself.
Well,
right?
But anyway, but it still flavored the viewing, which means, and you know me, I watch things in a certain eye and I can't help it unless I know I'm leaving my brain way over there sort of thing. Okay, so the scene I was talking about was the first time that Jack and Jenny have an affair, and they happen to have it at the dying side of Jack's wife when she's dying from terminal stage 4 cancer. And during the scene, you have a New Year's Eve moment where they're both looking at it and everything's done in slow motion with a voiceover.
Yes.
Anyway, one of my like kryptonites. In cinema.
You're just pushing my score further.
Oh, I want to be with you guys.
The kiss in slow motion, and then we see Stephen Bauer's face afterwards going...
Yeah, looking at the screen because his wife turns around with huge eyes staring at them.
That is such a giallo shot. Dude, that's giallo 101.
That's more, that's more giallo than it is Hitchcock.
So, to Jessica Sparling, to Neil Rickman, to Michelle Stang, who is, you know... I don't even know why I'm doing this. She's almost a co-host now. And to Cindy Gratton, and I don't know how to pronounce the second part of her surname. Can you help me out, David? It's Cindy Gratton. Jeez. How do you pronounce? Yeah. How do you pronounce the last? Because she's got an hyphenated surname. Dad, mom and dad, or she took her husband. I need to know how to pronounce.
Yeah, I'd have to look it up.
Can you read it? Can you try?
It's Gratton. Batras? Yeah.
There you go. So if we mispronounce it now, it's on you, so... to all of you, we love you, we need you, and this is a shout out to you. Well done. You listen to the show. Well done.
You railroaded me, mate.
I had to do it, though. I had to do it because we forgot to do it.
Yeah, no, you are correct. So what I find about some of this is that... it's like little pockets of great things. Like there's something that Lieutenant Terry says, and it's one of my favorite lines of this whole thing, is I don't want to be walking behind little coffins or baby coffins or something like that. It's so it's so cutting. And you're like, the mum. You said that in front of the mum.
Yes, yes.
Whatever you need, and do it fast. I don't want to be walking behind any little coffins.
I think it's ratings times.
All right. Look, Ricky's misgivings, I understand. This is not a perfect film by any stretch of the imagination, but I think this is De Palma at his most playful, if I dare say. I think he's having a lot of fun just creating weird set pieces. I don't think he's phoning it in. Watch this film. There's not a single shot of where he tries to do a split screen of having two different versions of John Lithgow talking to each other.
That's true.
And it's seamless. De Palma is working on he's working at his usual, I don't want to say usual, but his visual style, his visual language is just off the charts here. I think he's doing incredible work. Yeah, the story's a mess. The story's a mess. There's no getting around that. And I think
but you said something though. You said that this is De Palma at his most playful, and I think that's poignant because it is.
I think he's.
Apparently is not a joyous guy, right? It's really hard to get De Palma laughing on set, apparently. And he's from John Lithgow's mouth.
Yeah, he's a nightmare. I was telling Ricky while you were gone. So De Palma had a couple bombs with Casualties of War and Bonfire of the Vanities, and I think what this is De Palma kind of rediscovering what it was that made him fall in love with film, and he was able to kind of restart and reinvigorate himself to go on to do Carlito's Way and Mission Impossible and continue.
Man, I keep forgetting the Mission Impossible was him.
Yeah.
I just.
So it's a little bit of a mixed bag, but I think it's a really fun film. And to that, I give it 7.5. Closed circuit baby cameras.
Oh my God. That's fantastic. That is fantastic.
I've said a bit. I'm going to say some more now. There's a lot to this film that you do find joy in, but mm-hmm. I feel like it's a film in parts. So you can love the cinematography. You can love the acting. There's a lot of elements. I talked earlier about loving the car drowning scene because it's actually tense. It's actually suspenseful. There's something about it that seeing the way it's cut and edited, where he's like waiting to see whether the sun's going to rise. He's waiting to see if the car's going to sink. The wife suddenly getting up. There's a lot of suspense in it.
Can I ask you something about that scene? Because it's been nagging at me. Mm-hmm. There's a close-up. The first time we see the location is a close-up, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a wider shot. I don't think it's...
I don't think it's the same place.
The wider shot's beautiful. Yeah. Of course. Would it be the studio, maybe? Yeah, the soundstage?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure the wide shot is on location and the...
But they don't match that much, man. Because when the wide shot comes, it's like, oh, shit.
And the reason is for the safety of the actress, so she can look like she's drowning.
Yeah.
So, it's, of course, a soundstage. And, you know, it's the 90s.
You didn't want John Lithgow wading into a swamp and pushing a
car. Yeah, but then
again,
this argument doesn't work. And I can tell you, because when I watched Blowout, if you remember, what is it with De Palma drowning, dude?
He loves it.
Because there is... What is it? Maybe
it's a great Hitchcockian death.
Yeah, it's the only way he can come. Yeah. So I'm sorry.
It's like Black Dahlia, you know, whatever. It's just Bathwaters and all that stuff. Anyway,
is Black Dahlia him as well?
Yeah,
Black Dahlia was him.
Yeah. Wasn't Ethan Hawke? It was the other guy.
Josh Hartnett.
Yes. Josh Hartnett. Yeah, that's right. Sorry.
All right.
Go on. Sorry, you were saying.
Yeah.
Just say it.
Okay.
I fucked you up, didn't I?
Yeah, you did.
You don't remember.
So I'm going to give this...
You're talking about the drowning scene.
No, it's fine. I'm giving this 4.1. I was going to give it lower, maybe 3.6, but I'll give it 4.1 just to appease the gods that I'm talking to right now. What is it, a 4.1? It's a 4.1 little coffins that I have to walk behind because of how many babies are going to die.
Woo!
So, that, by the way, that means I'm not watching Raising Kane ever again. So thank you very much, De Palma, for your experience of Raising Kane. You can keep it.
I'm gonna make it my life mission.
All right.
Hey, wait a second. Aren't you coming here in December and you're spending two nights in my home?
Yes.
I think you know what to fire up.
If you put on Raising Kane, I will go sleep on the streets.
Well, I'm just gonna wait until it's late enough that you have no option.
Oh, I've got options. I know a lot of people in London. I will go.
I'm going to do the chloroform move, the car to that. Okay. I'm going to do a Bill Cosby.
I bet you will.
No way out of this. I dislike this movie deeply. And I don't even know. I was quite driven in getting the director's cut. We talked about it at the beginning of the podcast how I spent 15 minutes raging and pacing around my living room before putting the disc in. And I felt like I got robbed by Arrow. But next time you advertise your physical media, make sure you get it right. Because I wasn't sure, right? I had to go out of my way to get the cut that, you know, we needed to watch for this. I was primed to hate this movie. And yet again, I sat down with Annie. We watched it. I found it extremely enjoyable. Extremely enjoyable this time around. And maybe because I lowered my expectations so much. I mean, like I said, this was down there with Snake Eyes. So it was a joyous experience. And, you know, I think David hit the nail on the head. I think this is De Palma at his most playful. And I did watch Blowout. I mean, the conversation, the exchanges between Travolta, who looks fucking amazing in Blowout. Ultimately, I felt possibly like you did, Ricky, like you did all the way through the movie. I came into it and within 5 minutes I attuned to it. I found this to be quite fun. For me now, this is a 6.9 dodgy hotel keys, which, by the way, nobody talked about this move. Who the fuck? I haven't seen you in so long. Here's my hotel key. That is one of the most softcore porn moves you get. I don't know. I don't even know the proposition of giving somebody your hotel key, someone that you haven't seen in so long, someone that was there when you watched your wife die while you were kissing another woman. It's fucking, which, by the way, we didn't discuss the entire cuck thing between Carter and Kane. And on that note, this was Umba.
This is Ricky.
This was Dave.
It's not time to make a change. Just relax, take it easy. You're still young, that's your fault. There's so much you have to know. Find a girl, settle down. If you want, you can marry. Look at me, I am old, but I'm happy. I was once like you are now, and I know that it's not easy to be calm when you found something going on. But take your time, think a lot. Why, think of everything you've got, for you will still be here tomorrow, but your dreams may not. Explain when I do, he turns away again. It's always been the same, same old story. From the moment I could talk, I was ordered to listen. Now there's a way, and I know that I have to go away. I know I have to go.
Oh, stop it.
I know you, Kane.
Carter weakened and you stepped in. We all know your tough guy act. But we don't need a loose cannon here. Carter can finish this himself.
Let me tell you something, Doctor. I know Carter wants to help, but we're talking about stealing kids here and experimenting on them. You may need this loose cannon.
You should never have gotten out. You're nothing but a cheap hoodlum.
I am what you made me, Dad.
Shut up and finish your drink.
I already have.
And let me get you another.